Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you turn on Netflix right now, you may notice that the top 10 film viewings during International Black Lives Matter protests following the killing of George Floyd are movies like The Help, Green Book, or Crash. But these films are not necessarily the ones to turn to in order to learn more about race issues and racism. While films are a powerful medium and widely accessible, it's important to watch films that give accurate representations of events and are made by voices of color, whether it be fictional or documentary. Yoruba Richin is a documentary filmmaker whose most recent project was The Green Book, Guide to Freedom. As a Black filmmaker, she knows firsthand that while film is a powerful tool, there still remain significant industrial barriers that attribute to systemic racism. Brad Lichtenstein is president of 371 Productions here in Milwaukee, as well as a filmmaker, and they both join me now to talk about the influence of film and to also recommend which films to watch to help educate yourself on racism. Brad and Yoruba, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
So, Brad, you're a local filmmaker and leader of a production company here in Milwaukee that works to address social justice, but you said in a recent statement that that's simply not enough. So I was hoping if you could talk a bit about your recent comments following all the events that have since developed since the death of George Floyd.
Sure. Well, what I meant by that's not enough is it's not enough just to make films. It's really important to make sure that those films have an impact, that they bring people together, that they cause conversations and action around anti-racist work and how we can work on changing systems fundamentally, the systems that have operated with institutionalized racism for so long, and particularly systems that have also allowed police forces to be able to do what we all witness, which is murder men, Black men, without reprisal, and to constantly be able to defend their actions, which has to be changed. So that's some of what I meant by the statement that we issued.
And Yoruba, you're a filmmaker who explores issues of race, space, and power. Your whole frame of work is dedicated to that. And as someone who's been working on this topic for so long, in and out of the news cycles, but with this particular instance and the growing protests and the international call for justice, do you see a greater collective power of people paying attention now?
Yes, I think that is the one thing that gives me some glimmer of hope, even though I'm in this funny thing of, you know, especially when this all began, of feeling scared to be hopeful, you know, because we've been disappointed so many times. I just want to also point out too, in terms of what Brad said about, you know, witnessing Black men, that Black women have also been victims of this police violence and of state violence since the very beginning as well. But yes, I do think that we are seeing greater attention. I mean, you know, we're some of us, you know, are seeing this as a tipping point. The fact that things have happened so swiftly, I think, is, you know, is something new and different. The multiracialness of the protests is something new and different. Everyone has commented on that, from, you know, President Obama to Al Sharpton. You know, Sharpton's been in this fight for a long time. And that's one of the things that he said at Floyd's memorial, George Floyd's memorial, that's different this time. And, you know, we'll see, obviously it's the long term. We'll see what happens and we'll see what actually gets done after this moment passes. But I think there's cause for some hope.
So why do you both think that film is one of the best ways to explore issues and reach an audience, especially when it comes to issues of race and social justice?
You know, I think that we live, and certainly for my whole life, we've kind of lived in the media age. This is, you know, even before social media. There was no such thing as social media when I was growing up. But certainly media reflects, you know, impacts people in a way like nothing else does. And that's only increased. I don't think it's the only way. I don't think it's gonna, you know, save us. I think it has limits in what it can do as well. And that that needs to be done in conjunction with other means of education and, you know, consciousness. But it is the age, it is how people communicate, it's how people are impacted, how people you know, see the world. And so it's a very powerful medium and can spark, you know, these kind of conversations and these movements. I mean, I think if you look at a film like 13th, that had an impact that was incredible for, you know, people who did not even, you know, weren't necessarily, you know, documentary watchers. And I think 13th, which looks at the criminal justice system and the history of it, comes out at a moment where we're talking about criminal justice. And this is even before, you know, the present day with what's going on, but that we are actually, you know, able to, and that politicians are able to talk about criminal justice reform movements. I remember in the 80s and 90s where if you advocated for criminal justice reform, you were considered, you know, soft on crime. And that was from both parties. That wasn't, you know, just the Republicans. So all these things come out in conjunction with each other, and I think brings us to this moment. I think film is part of that.
And I would just add that I think in particular, independent film and the world of documentaries, many of which are PBS documentaries, take people to places that they wouldn't learn about in school or in their lives. And case in point, I was just before this call going through transcripts for a film that we're doing about the joint football team between Shorewood and Messmer, which Audrey, I think you know about. And the coach, I'm reading the transcript, and the coach is talking about Bayard Rustin, who is largely left out of textbooks that deal with the civil rights movement. He's Black and he's gay, and he was the organizer of the March on Washington, but we almost always learn about that in history books in the frame of Dr. King. So it was this character in our film talking about how he learned from a documentary about Bayard Rustin and also about the discrimination and the anti-gay culture that kept him out of the story that obviously changed the face of the civil rights movement in America. So those are the kinds of reasons why these kinds of films are really important to keep putting out there.
So let's get into some films that 371 Productions, Brad, you put out a list of films that people can watch from their homes right now to help better educate themselves. So Yoruba, since we have you here, I need to ask you, of course, about The Green Book Guide to Freedom, your documentary.
Yes. So my film came out last, oh gosh, where are we?
It was only last year.
Last February. And it's a documentary about the Green Book, which was an African-American travel guide that was created to help African-Americans navigate Jim Crow America, both the South, Northwest, and actually the world. It was started by a man named Victor Green in 1936 and was published through 1968. And it was a way to help us know businesses that would accept us, that were not segregated, places that we can go as we traveled, by car, but also, you know, by train. This was the Green Book also mirrored the timing of the Great Migration generally. And it also was a compendium of Black businesses and businesses that not only served us, but that were pillars in their community. So it was a very important way that African Americans got around, but also that created these sort of, as someone says in the film, these parallel universes that we were living in. And so the film chronicles some of the businesses in the Green Book, the movements that were happening at the time that led to the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1965, which, you know, the Green Book then, when things were opened up and African Americans could go, you know, there was de facto segregation was, you know, outlawed. A lot of these businesses suffered, actually. And so instead of going to the local Black-owned motel, they would go to the Holiday Inn. So the Green Book ceased publication in 1968. So the film tells that story and tells the story of how this book helped build a vibrant Black middle class.
So Brad, on to you. Your film, Ghosts of Attica, can you briefly explain what that's about and the significance of encouraging audiences to watch this now?
Well, and I'll point out that, you know, Ghosts of Attica is a film about the Attica prison uprising in 1971, and it prominently features the lead attorney for a group who came to be known as the Attica Brothers. They were prisoners during the standoff between prisoners and the state which lasted for 5 days. And then Governor Rockefeller called out the state troopers who came in. And if you can imagine, they dropped tear gas on the outside yard, cordoned in by four fences, four big brick walls. Tear gas comes down, you can't see anything. And then the troopers came in with shotguns, which spread, the bullets spread 10 feet every inch, I believe, 10 feet wide every inch. So they were just shooting indiscriminately. And when it was all done, 29 inmates and 11 hostages, which were guards, were killed. And there was an investigation, and then there was a cover-up, and then there was an investigation of the investigation, and another cover-up. And eventually the truth came out. That journey took about 30 years. And we made that film at the 30th anniversary because the inmates, the Attica brothers, were finally getting their day in court, in which they were arguing for compensation for the damages for the people who were killed and maimed at Attica, which was just a bloodbath. It's also, from a standpoint of what we're talking about, kind of a relic. I mean, if I was making that film today, I have a much different view around who gets to tell whose stories. And I would have partnered at least with a Black filmmaker who felt comfortable working with me to tell that story. Back in that day, which was 1999 and 2000, I operated with a different sense of awareness and obligation around those issues.
Can I ask, Brad, because it's very interesting to hear, because 1999, 2000 isn't, well, I guess it's a long time ago, but then it isn't a long time ago, right?
Like, yeah.
At the same time. And thinking about what, you know, not just you, but what do you think has shifted where there is some recognition, you know, from in your life and, you know, from other maybe white institutions that people of color need to tell their own stories?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's interesting because I think I would hold myself accountable kind of in the way you just suggested, because even way back in 1988, I think it was, I was a student activist at my college, and we had a big discussion when we took over the school around issues of inclusion and diversity. Back then we called it cultural diversity. When we took over the school kind of in the wake of divestment and so forth, the organizers had a conversation among ourselves around this very thing, who should lead? And we made the decision collectively that students of color should lead. And that was both public and private, you know, behind the scenes as well. So it's interesting, you know, your question, like when I made Attica, I think at first I probably didn't think of it as a Black film. I think I thought about it as a history film. In the sense that, you know, the Attica prison, I say uprising, I used to say riot before I started making the film, was a film about a moment in history. And one of my colleagues actually had sort of started the film for, you know, a different distributor, and then it changed and I got obsessed with it. I started reading the records. And I was reading the records initially from like a standpoint of, you know, they're investigative, like there were murders here that have never been accounted for. Mm-hmm. And then I met Frank Big Black Smith, who became a really close friend actually through the course of that film. And it's a long story. I mean, his funeral is one of the most profound experiences of my life. Mm-hmm. As I was making the film, I think that I probably didn't have the language that we have now in our discussion within our community around documentary and decolonization, but Black actually put the big kibosh on my access until we had a lot of conversations around making the film. And a lot of those conversations were around, what's my point of view? You know, what's my lens? How are you going to tell this story? And it shaped the mm-hmm. way that we ended up telling the story, which was a lot about a kind of, it's very intimate from largely his point of view, and also a political conversion that happened in the yard during that standoff, where he came to realize what the audience comes to realize, that the state is racist and the state was bent on murdering, the language back then would be third world peoples. That was kind of the movement language, you know, without any expectation of accountability. So I don't know if I have an answer, but that's kind of, you know, the thought process that was happening in my own sort of personal trajectory.
So what about the film, I Am Not Your Negro?
So I Am Not Your Negro is a meditation upon race in this country. I mean, just race in this country. And it uses the words of the great James Baldwin to investigate what it means to be Black in America. I mean, and everything from racial violence to Hollywood representation to issues around masculinity. And it's just a beautiful essay film using the words of James Baldwin of exploring this issues and of all these issues that are timeless issues for African Americans. So that's highly recommended. And it is airing on PBS this Wednesday with Stanley Nelson's Black Panther, Vanguard of the Revolution, which is a comprehensive documentary about the Black Panthers, which, you know, is really important to know that history as well.
All right. And then with so many protests spreading internationally, the documentary Whose Streets would be a valuable thing to look back on.
Definitely. I mean, Whose Streets, I think, is really valuable as an on-the-ground document of what's going on, of what's happening in Ferguson after the killing of Michael Brown for walking on the sidewalk. I think that's why he was stopped.
In 2014.
And so a lot of the film, what's so powerful about it is that the film is uses the documentation that activists were doing, like from their phones and, you know, news reports at the time, really documenting what is going on. And it follows, I think, three or four activists, local activists, who are out there protesting for change. And if you remember at that time, you know, there were a lot of the things that we're seeing nationally were happening in Ferguson, you know, a militarization of police, curfews, vandalism, quote unquote, or looting. But it was all happening in this concentrated area, in concentrated city in Ferguson. And that film really documents the impact of these protests on these activists' lives.
Yoruba Richin is a documentary filmmaker, and Brad Lichtenstein is president of 371 Productions here in Milwaukee. There's plenty more to our conversation, as well as more film suggestions, and you can find both of those at wuwm.com.